Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we are actually live at the ADCS Technology Conference in Chicago. And for this episode, we're really fortunate to be joined by Dr. Jill Weisberg-Benchel. And so, if you don't mind, just telling our viewers a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Hi, I'm Jill, and I am a pediatric psychologist and a certified diabetes care and education specialist. I have worked on diabetes teams for over 30 years. I do not have diabetes myself. I think that's important. And all of my clinical and research work has really been focused on working with children and teenagers and their parents about how to live their best life. That sounds really silly, but to live their best life in spite of the fact that their body doesn't make enough insulin, and to overcome some of the challenges around the demanding regimen, around the fact that we have really terrible ways of managing blood sugars. Basically, like, it's just not great, it's not physiologic, and sometimes people feel like things should be perfect when they can't be. And to talk about how to manage questions that friends might ask or family members might ask, assumptions that people make, all of the new technologies and how to figure out how to fit that into their lives. Just, basically living well with diabetes.
I love that. I do. I love that. So, being at the technology meeting, can you tell us a little bit about your research with AID systems?
Sure. So I was really fortunate enough to partner with a large group of people that are behavioral health specialists, led by Kath Barnard in England, and Lori LaFell at Joslin, Corey Hood at Stanford. And we created this assessment that was funded through Helmsley Charitable Trust to really ask the question, what are the psychosocial factors that might really drive somebody to do well with a hybrid closed loop system, and what might be some of the things that would be perceived barriers. So how do we find out what will facilitate doing well and what might be the challenges or barriers and things that might make it harder to use these systems? And so we reached out to children and teenagers and parents and adults of the entire basically age range. So from adults that say you're an adult when you're 18, at least legally in the United States, all the way to people in their 70s and 80s, and got their feedback about what their hopes, dreams, desires, needs, wishes would be for those systems. And based on that information, we were able to develop a survey. It's the Inspire survey for anybody in your audience that does research. And it assesses basically positive expectancies of people that might be interested in starting a hybrid closed loop system. And the cool thing about that, besides just being able to hear everybody's voice and really learning from people that live with diabetes every day what it was that they wanted, which I will, with all due respect, say that many companies don't actually hear patient voice when they're developing products. I think people are getting better and better at that, but we still have a long way to go, in my opinion. So this was just really incredibly helpful and rich information. And the cool thing is that this measure has now been accepted by the Food and Drug Administration as an approved patient-reported outcome measure. So all of the new systems that are being assessed for FDA approval have to use that measure as
Wow.
part of their assessment.
Right.
So the psychology of living with diabetes and closed loop systems is now integrated, which is really cool.
Which is really cool
Yeah.
because I don't think in the past, none of us really, oh, that person's struggling with diabetes. But diabetes is such a psychological, there's so much of it that is you're failing, you're not failing, you're eating the wrong thing. If you only did this, if you didn't do that, if you stood on your
There's
left
nothing
foot,
that's wrong
right?
that you're eating and it tastes delicious, with all due
Exactly,
respect.
right? But
So,
those
right.
things, those thoughts, the guilt, those are the things that we are only now just beginning to talk about, right? And
Right.
that whole behavioral health that goes with improving patient outcomes.
Right.
Right. You know, I think that's so important when we interact with patients at all.
And the cool thing is that now the different research teams that are studying the different closed loop systems, right? So the team at Tandem and the Cambridge team,
right?
They've all and the Islet team, they've all now integrated behavioral health specialists. I think they're all psychologists, but just in case I'm wrong, I'll just say behavioral health specialists into their assessment and into their pivotal trials and ongoing studies using these products in the real world,
right?
To really get a sense from families, what is it like to use these systems? Is it improving your quality of life? Is it reducing diabetes to stress? Does it have an impact on your sleep? Do you feel like you have more flexibility? Like, what are the psychosocial impacts? Because, and Kath Bernard says this all the time, the most expensive mistake that we can make is having somebody buy a product and then it stays in their drawer.
Right.
So it might really improve time in range. It might really reduce A1C, but if the perceived burdens are so overwhelming, right, then people aren't going to use it. So there has to be a blend, a good partnership, a shoulder-to-shoulder partnership between engineers and psychologists and families and people that not only have diabetes themselves, but those that love them.
So that it reminds me, so Aaron Kowalski was the keynote speaker,
right,
and he had that image in his presentation of a woman that was basically catatonic, right, hooked up to this like huge AID system,
right,
but so she had maybe her time in range was like 100%, but she was catatonic.
She had
so,
no life.
Right.
She had no life.
Right. So yeah. How do you balance all of that? And I think that, you know, Laurel Messer wrote this amazing editorial recently where she talks about this. I'm not going to get the words right. So Laurel, I apologize for not getting the words right. But it was something like all of this like hype and excitement about new technologies as they come out. Everybody believes it is going to just like fix everything.
Right.
And people are going to love it and their outcomes are going to be great. Their medical outcomes are going to be great. And then she calls, I think she calls, it's not the pit of despair, but it's just, it's something like that where like people like have all these expectations and then real life hits, right?
Right.
Trough of despair, I think is what she calls it. And then comes reality. Like what are the unique variables that these systems offer? What is the thing that makes life better for people that live with diabetes and what doesn't? And let's
right.
be realistic about it because we don't have a cure, right? It's just different things that maybe are reducing some of the burden. And every time we reduce the burden, we're moving in the right direction.
Right.
But what the other thing is, what might reduce the burden for somebody who's a parent of a toddler?
Right.
Might be very, very different than a teenager. Might
right.
be very, very different than the three sport athlete in high school. Might be really, really different than somebody in college. Might be really, really different than somebody is in their 60s and their partner, their spouse.
Right.
And so everybody has different needs. And I think that there's now the very beginnings of recognition that there's never going to be one system that meets everybody's needs.
Right.
And we need to be really like skeptical about that, about right. the hype, right?
Right. Yeah.
And let's just keep moving forward.
And I think that is, some of it is, you know, you read the material, right? And you hear these things and it's like, and people will post online these flat lines. And
liars.
I had a flatline, me too, last Thursday, right? But like when you
stress out,
right? Exactly, right? Like if I don't eat or move, I'm really good. But, you know, so having that conversation with patients and talking about the things that make blood sugars high beyond just whether you ate and walked a mile before 2 o'clock and stood on your left foot the right way, I think is so important. And I think that we as clinicians, all of us, have to make sure that we're addressing that, right? That we're, oh, your parents are getting divorced. Of course, your blood sugar's high. That's a stressor, and you have that conversation. You're, you know, you're worried about your son, your grandson, your spouse is being a jerk this week, whatever it is, those things, holidays, right? Family vacations that are supposed to be wonderful can be very stressful, and you can, but jobs, right? Patients are people, and you and I say that back and forth to each other. They're people, and things happen to them,
right?
Looking at the psychological is a newer thing, right? And adding that to technology, what do you do when you have a family that wants perfection? And how do you start that conversation?
Well, it makes me sad, first of all, that families walk in hoping somehow that if they get the algorithm right, there's going to be perfection. Because truly, there's no other part of our lives where we look for perfection.
Right.
So I'm a little bit baffled, honestly, with where does that even goal, hope, message come from, that there's even the remote possibility of perfection?
Right.
Where does that even come from? I haven't gotten the answer yet. But I do think that it's pretty clear that there is no such thing as perfection when it comes to biology. Like, we are constantly changing biological systems.
Right.
And we're always adapting and changing. And so our body's always adjusting. So it's
baffling your mind.
It's baffling my mind. It's so tough.
Right.
Yeah, but
right.
I think so many people have it. It's like this all, so like this all or nothing thinking too.
Right.
Really, it's fascinating.
It is all or nothing. And I think there are a couple of things we can do to battle it. I think at diagnosis, every member of a multidisciplinary diabetes team, and I really hope that everybody has the opportunity to meet members of a multidisciplinary diabetes team, that each member is going to underscore the fact that perfection is not possible and it is never a goal. That we might be trying to address certain times of day where we're getting closer to our target range for specific reasons, but we don't have the tools. Like, the way that insulin is administered, that's not physiologic.
Right.
So how in the world are we going to expect that we're going to achieve anywhere near the same glycemic variability than somebody whose pancreas makes insulin all the time? Like, it's just biologically impossible. So I think that message has to be given again and again. As somebody who works in pediatrics, I think a piece of the perfection thing is, as a parent, I have silently promised that I am going to protect my child from everything in the world that can ever happen that's unfair. That's my job, right? So when your child is diagnosed with something that is profoundly, cosmically unfair, like diabetes, it is a gut punch of epic proportions, right? Because it's so wrong. And so I think that parents try, not necessarily on purpose,
right,
but try to do everything they can to protect their child from all those scary things that you hear about in the future. I
right.
do not want my child to have problems with their eyes, with their kidneys, with their feet, with fertility. I don't want diabetes to ever affect their longevity. And therefore, I'm going to micromanage everything so that I can protect in the future.
Right.
By accident, sometimes in the pediatric world, because parents become so sort of focused on that, they lose the joy in their children. In the just everyday silliness and new word development and like poop jokes,
right,
you know, like,
right,
well,
right,
right, like
right.
whatever it is, like they're so much focused on biology that you can't control anyway,
right,
that they lose the joy of being a family and the silliness of
right.
just being together. That I worry about too. I also worry that parents, and Natalie, you and I have talked about this in some of our shared work together, that sometimes by accident, parents also give their children the message that you are never going to be safe unless I'm with you.
Right, right.
And that's right.
Right.
That's also a very worrisome, as a psychologist, that really worries me, because instead we want our children to make mistakes.
Yes.
To right. learn from them.
Right.
You know, especially teenagers.
Right.
And you and I have talked about that, you know, ridiculous teenager decision making. You look at them and you go, how'd that work for you?
Right.
Didn't work
right.
so well, did it?
Right.
So what do you think you'd do the next time, right?
Right?
But if the message is somehow that you can't even try to make mistakes.
Right.
Because I have to be there to protect you.
Right.
Because your pancreas doesn't make enough insulin. I worry about that messaging and giving children that ability to literally explore all of the amazing things that they could possibly be or do.
Right. Because it narrows their life, because mom has to, or dad has to, parent, or whoever that is.
I'm not safe unless
right.
I have a provider.
Right. Right.
Right. Whoever that provider is.
Right.
And it's just not true.
Right. Yeah. And that wraps back up to, what was your number at school today? Not how was your day? Right. That is that basic interaction with your child when they walk in the door, or your spouse, not how was your interview? What happened? I saw you were 264 before. What did you eat? Right. And that awful interaction of There's guilt. There you go. You did it wrong. Had you not, or
why are you high? Why are what you, did
right,
you eat?
Right. Or
those two yep. questions imply that that person maliciously and intentionally did something wrong.
Right.
I don't meet many people that purposely and intentionally do something wrong.
Right.
I don't meet very many people that wake up in the morning and say, what can I do today to increase the chance that I'm going to have poor outcomes in the future?
Right.
People
right.
don't do that.
No, not even.
So there's right. life that gets in the way.
Right.
That's okay. That's right. human.
Right.
Right. And the amazing thing is, and again, I've only been in this field for 30 years. But I've seen so many changes that make it more and more possible.
Right.
To be able to fix things if they're not what you want them to be. We right. have more tools than we did before.
I'm curious. So I work with adults, but a lot of times people will come to me and say, well, I fell off the wagon. Like I wasn't, like I want to do this, but I'm not able to do this. What, I guess, advice do you have for us in terms of, like, how can we help people? Like, I guess, maybe inspire motivation. Any words of wisdom?
So fell off the wagon is, you know, oh my goodness. So that means that you're already feeling guilty.
Right.
So right. I'd like to just sort of say, like, we're going to stop that because there's no utility in it.
Right.
But, so guilt makes you feel shamed, makes you feel bad about yourself. It compares you to other people who are doing it better. Probably not. I think everybody struggles.
Right.
So I would first thank them for coming in and get rid of the guilt and say, let's look at, you know, I would find out about their life and their demands and what's going on. And then you might start to think about some areas where you think that it would be a great idea to start, but I wouldn't go there. I would say, so here are like a whole bunch of things that we could begin to work on. We're only going to do one thing at a time because, and we might only do a half of a one thing or a quarter of a one thing. What's most interesting to you? And it might not right. be the thing that you as a diabetes care professional really wants to work on, right? But they chose it, which means right. you've listened to them. They had the power. They had the choice. They're going to come back to clinic the next time.
Right. Right? Yeah.
And
right.
if you sort of see this as a long-term goal where you're establishing a partnership and a relationship and you're walking down that path with them in the ups and downs and you're still going to be there, then they're going to continue to work.
I love
and
that.
That's
approach.
Gonna be amazing.
Right? Yeah, because I feel bad, right? When someone says that, it's like they're saying I don't know, like I feel like a failure, and that's not at all
right.
what it
diabetes yeah. is so hard.
It's right? so, and it's, so hard.
You know, because I don't live with it.
Yeah. Right.
But the families that have been kind enough to share their experiences with me, diabetes is really
right.
hard.
Right.
Even when your numbers are sort of like playing nicely in the sandbox with you,
it's
so
still
hard, it's exhausting, right. and you never get a break.
Right. I think the other side of it too is when someone comes in and says, I fell off the wagon, what they're saying is the rest of my life, the person behind the number is there's other stuff on the burners right yeah. now. So you look at them and say, of course this had to go to the back burner. It can't yeah. be your mom is sick. This happened.
You lost a job, right? But you were caring for somebody that was in the hospital.
Right. You fell and broke your foot. You did whatever.
Right.
And that is it that you fell off, or is it that we just, now you're ready to refocus?
And I think sometimes it comes back to the perfection, because I yes. think people feel like they have to do like
right.
everything
right.
like, perfectly.
Right. Other providers. So when I go yeah. to clinic, I need to show somehow that I'm motivated.
Right.
I don't know what that means actually. And that I care. And so I want you to really be impressed with me as a patient, and I as a patient want to please you.
Right.
And you're, that's kind of
right.
that's backwards.
Because they come and they say, you're going to be so disappointed in me.
No, right. Or you're going to be mad at
right.
me.
You're going to yell at me. Just
yeah,
to keep Diana had a patient that said, you're going to yell at me. Yeah,
No, I'm not.
Right. So I have a really good closing question.
Okay.
Tell us why you decided to become a CDCDS. What made you say, I do have a PhD, you're Dr. Jill Weisberg-Benchel, and you're at Lurie Children's, and you've got hundreds of publications.
No, but okay.
It feels like it's me, right? Tell me what made you take that next step.
Well, when I did my post, so backstory is, as I was getting my PhD in clinical psychology, I was going to work with juvenile first offenders. That was my favorite group of people to work with. And then I did an internship, which you have to do to get your PhD in clinical psychology. It's like an intensive clinical year. It happened to be in a hospital setting where I got to work with children that had chronic and acute illness. And I was like, oh, my word, I love this. This is my favorite group of people to ever work with. This is what I want to do. And that's a subspecialty called pediatric psychology. Well, I hadn't been trained in pediatric psychology, so I had to get a postdoctoral fellowship to be able to get trained.
Right, yeah.
Well, right, because this is really where I wanted to focus and I didn't have enough skill. And I was fortunate enough to get a postdoctoral fellowship under Doug Tynan as a psychologist and Alan Glasgow as the diabetologist at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. And at the end of my fellowship, Dr. Glasgow said, I would like to hire you as our first psychologist we've ever had as part of the diabetes team. But we don't have anybody that works on our team if you're not a CDCES. And I said, oh, this is terrifying. I do not understand pathophysiology. I know very little about adult work, and I know nothing about gestational diabetes. And he said, that's okay, I will teach you.
Right.
And so he literally sat down and taught me mm-hmm. and guided me. And then I sat for the exam and I passed. I know. And it was so long ago that every couple of years you had to sit and retake the exam.
Right.
And believe it or not, I actually liked that because it forced me to catch up on things that I was behind on. So I think I was smarter then.
Right. Because now you're dealing with CMEs and,
right,
and so it's
exactly.
different. Right.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So right. I know less and less I think about, like, you know, geriatric diabetes
right.
and gestational diabetes, not that I work in that area anyway, and more about technology and teenagers and young adults and children.
Right, but there's so
that's,
few. How many, do you know how many?
I think there are 20 psychologists in the country that also have certification, and so we need more. We need
right.
lots more. And so the American Diabetes Association and ISPAD both have standards of care that mandate or recommend, it's not mandated, right? Recommend that you have a behavioral health specialist integrated into your clinic, that person sees everybody at diagnosis and at least annually, including annual psychosocial screens and the availability and ability to provide psychosocial support, behavioral health support. And I think almost no programs actually meet those standards of care.
Right.
There are a few, but there
right.
are very few.
Right.
We need a lot more.
We do. We do. I mean, I believe in my heart and soul that if we don't address the psychological aspects of diabetes, we're missing such a big part of the management that patients end up, they just don't, their outcomes aren't as good.
Well,
right?
Just think for a minute about just like toddlers and preschoolers for a second, right? So, you know, we know that sometimes when there's more demands on them, they're more likely to say no.
Right.
No is like their favorite word, right?
Right.
So the more opportunities you give them to say no, the more opportunities they're going to take. If you then add at that developmental stage more must-dos, like checking glucose close and giving insulin and having to eat, like
right.
literally you have to sit at that table and eat.
Right.
We are increasing the demands and increasing the opportunity for no, right? So it starts even for those little ones. And so if you have a behavioral health person that understands development, child development, you can develop strategies to decrease the chance of those temper tantrums and the no's and increase cooperation.
Because you're taking away something else. Right. You're saying, how many things do we have? We have to do this.
How do I give you
right.
choice and control over
right.
things?
Right.
Yep. And so having somebody guide families in typical child development and then integrate diabetes in a healthy and adaptive way.
Right.
It's really important.
Right.
I'm biased because I'm a psychologist.
Just, right,
so,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
But I think that we have an important role in partnership.
I love it.
Yeah.
I do.
And it doesn't have to be psychopathology. I don't want anybody to wait until somebody's hurting
right.
before they meet a behavioral health person. I want them to sort of see this as there are going to be ups and downs naturally. And having to deal
right.
with something that's unfair and demanding and sometimes completely unpredictable. Right. But I'm guessing, Natalie, I'm just going to sort of throw you under the bus for a minute. I'm guessing that there have been times in your life when you have not been able to get your numbers under 250 or 300 for more than 7 or 8 hours,
yes,
no matter what you've
absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely.
Or there are days when you've been under 70 and you're doing everything you can to get up and you can't.
Yes.
And so, like, So there are times when diabetes so doesn't play by the rules,
right?
And if somebody says that's because you're a bad patient or you've made bad decisions or this is your fault, how do you get over that?
Right.
If somebody says, yeah, of course, this is hard and I'm with you on this journey and we're going to do this together and today was awful, but tomorrow's going to be better.
Right.
If you don't have people like that, it's just harder and it doesn't have to.
So I know we said it was the last question, but I just have to ask you because so often I hear people say, well, oh, that A1C is good or that A1C is bad. Those numbers are good. Those numbers are bad. And what can we do to kind of change the focus? Because, of course, numbers cannot inherently be good or bad,
right? They cannot. And what happens is inadvertently people internalize that as I am good or I am bad. I have made good decisions. I have made bad decisions. And that brings shame.
Right.
And there's just no utility in that because shame makes people feel demoralized and it makes them give up. So by accident, when providers use good and bad, it actually increases the chance that people are not going to follow up and they're going to feel really poorly about themselves and their adherence, if I can use that word, or their self-care behaviors are going to decline. So it's really important to use different language, and there have been some really nice publications about the importance of language that I would encourage, you know, your podcast listeners to read about. But things like, it looks like, over the last couple of weeks, things have just been a little bit harder for you. I'd love to hear a little bit about why. Like, what do you think is going on?
Right.
And it, you know, it could just be like, I bet you've been growing a lot. I am so happy that you're growing, right? So if you've got a kid that's in the middle of a growth spurt, of course their blood sugars are going to go higher because they've got growth hormones, you know, and probably other hormones that are affecting numbers. And so I think that just sort of partnering without that label, without that judgment, right? If there's any way that we can use non-judgmental and collaborative language, I think that we're just, people are going to come back. I want people to say, I can't wait to see my nurse educator. Yeah. I can't wait to see my, physician. I can't wait to see my diabetes provider.
Right. That's such a big part of it because then you can help catch them when they're at their highs and their lows.
And they're going to come to you then and say, you know what, Natalie, the last few days have been so hard.
Right.
And I don't know what to do. And you can say, tell me about it.
Right.
And now they've invited you into their lives. You're a partner in problem solving. And you might not have the fix, whatever that is, but at least you're on a journey with them and they're not alone.
And they can hate diabetes with you together, right? We can just be upset. We can be sad by the effort that you're putting
without
in.
Being mentally.
Right, exactly. Being mentally. Right, we can do this together hand in hand.
Yeah, and that thing that makes all the difference, especially when the meeting's hard.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
That's true for everything in our life.
Isn't
right?
It though? Right, yeah. With friends, with spouses, with everything, with other clinicians, right? That bonding that you get to say, I thought about you the other day. I saw a patient that did this or that or whatever, right? Yeah.
Right.
Oh my gosh. That shared experience.
Yeah. I'm loving this conversation. I feel like I could really listen to you all day.
Right.
Thank you so much
for joining us.
Thanks
for joining me.
Appreciate it. And thanks everyone for tuning in to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.